I fear I may be bound to disappoint after that introduction, but I hope not. Let me thank Dean McCarty, and thanks to Helmut and to the Robert Penn Warren Center for having extended this invitation, and to the benefactor, Harry Howard, whom I'm sorry he can't be here, and I'm sure we all wish him well. And it's a delight to see many friends and former colleagues and in a larger sense, colleagues in this audience. I heard Robert Penn Warren read a poem, the Phi Beta Kappa poem at Harvard, I guess must be about 15, 20 years ago now. It was, I can't tell you what the poem was, but I remember being impressed by it as well I should have been. Penn Warren was obviously known for his sense of place, the South in particular. Indeed, I've just come from one of his places. My daughter is teaching at Tulane, and I spent the weekend in New Orleans, and some of the King's Men atmosphere still pervades that place. And I'd like to think he'd engage with this lecture, although he probably would disagree what I'll have to say, the parts where I talk about place. So I propose, so thank you again, and I will be experimenting. This is my first effort at PowerPoint for a large audience, so hopefully it will, but the controls seem to have disappeared from the screen that I'm supposed to punch. Oh, okay. That will work flawlessly. I propose to speak today about territory or political space and its historical development. And this is an inquiry which, as Helmut said, has captured my attention, and I'll try to justify the intellectual concern and the energy invested in it. I've published some preliminary thoughts in two essays. One the historians here have probably seen, that is the article in the American Historical Review in the year 2000 on consigning the 20th century to history, and the other more systematic article entitled Transformations of Territoriality, which I published in a Festschrift for my German friend and colleague Jürgen Kocke. The essay is in English, the collection as a whole is in German. Nationale Geschichtswissenschaft. But I'm now working further on what I hope will be a book-length treatment, and I will share certain aspects of that today. Until recently, historians have tended to take territory as a rather unchanging underlay of history. States fought about the extent of their territory, but territory as such has remained something like water for fish. It's a precondition or a medium for the existence of states, but it's not a quality that has its own history. Max Weber defined the state as that association which enjoys a monopoly of legitimate violence in a given territory. And territory, he insisted in that phrase, was integral to the definition. Now, most of the political scientists or others discussing Weber's famous phrase have parsed the concepts of legitimacy and violence, but left territory for granted. By territory, I refer to portions of the Earth's surface over which authority can be exerted, political authority especially. Territory is not just land, and it's not even extensive land. It is global space that has been partitioned for the sake of political control. With about 180 states in the world today, almost, I guess, all of global space has been partitioned, perhaps Antarctica being an exception. Frontier and territory is the division of Earth's space into frontiers, surface space. Frontiers, in turn, supposedly establish the reach of legal authority and of economic and social policy, the official use of language, and the entry and sometimes the exit of people, goods, money, and even of ideas. The prerequisite of political authority is the capacity to erect borders, that is, membranes or frontiers within which an authority, a government, can attain supremacy, sovereignty, or of legal coercion. What Weber was thinking about and what the theorists of the late 16th century, such as Jean Baudin, termed sovereignty. One can have fuzzy or partially defined frontiers, but some separation of inside from outside is crucial for creating political space or territory. Now, of course, social scientists and ordinary folk use territory in a less formal way. Nomadic peoples, so-called tribes, those who over a yearly cycle follow a migratory route to pasture animals or to hunt, are aware of their territory and of those who intrude onto it. Urban gangs and others use the related concept of turf. There have been many bloody conflicts over this sort of fuzzily demarcated territory, as among American Indian tribes in the 18th century. I've chosen an illustration. These are unfortunately don't come out too well, but the medium is the message in this. This illustration shows the Sahel region at the southern edge of the Sahara that crosses the northern Nigeria border, where Tuareg and Hausa divide a common ecological region without regard to formal state borders. Still, each tribe has its own governance structure and a sense of its own bounded space. So I am going to use territory, though, in a more formal sense. These are territories, these are Tuaregs, and I guess these are houses, and they flow back and forth. I admit this comes from a French geographical text, and it's rather, it's not immediately clear, but the idea will convey the notion of a territory without a state border. But that's not what I really want to talk about. I want to use the very formal sense of territory, which I guess in Western societies we can say originates or comes into prominence at the time of the Treaties of Westphalia in the mid-17th century. By the end of this, it comes into, in fact, usage before that. By the end of the 16th century, so Quentin Skinner explains, the concept of the state had become, in his words, the most important object of analysis in European political thought. Although deep into the 18th century, rulers insisted they might personify state authority against all rivals, lawyers and clerics had established the modern idea of the state as, to quote Skinner, the form of public power separate from both the ruler and the ruled, and constituting the supreme political authority within a certain defined territory. Again, territory is crucial, but territory is used as a sort of throwaway concept. But Weber and even Skinner, as late as the 1970s, were writing when territory could be taken for granted. A generation later, however, we live in an era when territory seems to be dissolving under our feet. We use the term globalization to describe all those trends that have eroded our firm sense of territory. I like to express this by taking a small verse by the Greek poet Kafafis or Kafavi, who wrote toward the beginning of the last century, without consideration, without mercy, without scruples, they have created high walls around me. And now, in here, I do nothing but grow desperate. Thinking about this fate obsesses me and gnaws at me. For I had a lot to get done outside. Oh, had I but stayed alert while they built the walls. But I never heard the noise of the masons or their voices. They closed me off from the world without my knowledge. Well, what I'm proposing is that in light of our modern preconceived perceptions, Kafavi had it backward. Suppose while his attention lapsed, the walls were dismantled, and he felt not desperate at being shut in, but defenseless against the world outside. And this, I believe, is more the insecurity that seems to pervade many discussions of such contemporary phenomena as mass immigration, job loss, climate change, terrorism, international finance, and the like. I have expressed this by saying that until recently, and I think the 1970s are a critical transition, identity space, that is the territorial unit which oriented our loyalties and allegiances, usually the nation state, was perfectly congruent with authority space, the area that our national state might regulate and control, whether in terms of movements of people, of economic flows, and of security. Public loyalties and public capacities supposedly coincided, except when a country was defeated in war. Territory used to provide a resource for societies to enforce important collective outcomes. And those outcomes included who belonged and who was foreign, how wealth was generated and distributed, how the domain of the sacred must be honored, how families reproduced themselves. At the same time, territory specified the domain of powerful collective loyalties. Political and often ethnic identity was territorial. And the history of nationality and of nationalism has focused on the relationship, the growing congruence up until recently, among these variables and between these two sets of spaces. But that is not my story. Today, these domains of identity space and decision space no longer coincide so pervasively. Now, over the last quarter century or so, globalization, to use that general term, has impinged on the public imagination as the supposedly unprecedented force that was subverting a habitual and long-standing geospatial ordering of the world. In fact, globalization has had many precedents over the years, but that is not the issue here. Territoriality seems less a resource for guaranteeing livelihoods, excluding foreigners, or maintaining coherence of values. It no longer provides the same capacity for control, even if territories remain the nexus of primary allegiance. Now, we have a... This is from the École des Sciences Politiques in Paris, publishes a wonderful Atlas de la Mondialisation of Globalization. Unfortunately, it, I don't know what happens as these things are scanned, but in any case, this is a direct foreign investment. This is one of the forces supposedly undermining territorial control, and as is familiar to many of you, and these squares represent the size, scale of foreign investment in different places in the European Union and the United States, etc. Another typical index would be auto production. This is Toyota auto production, and as you can see, parts and pieces are made here and sent there, and in Japan and sent down to South Africa and America, Latin America. It's a lovely set of arrows, and the arrows, in a sense, infringe our old set of concept of territory, and there's the production and the sale and centers of research and development in different countries. And finally, just another little sketch of what globalization is usually conceived of. Here is the story of migration. We are at the top, and the numbers go up, and in Europe is increasingly, you know, increased now, the European Union above us, etc. And so these are the indices and the drawings that suggest that something has changed. Now, it may be useful, I've talked about identity space, decision space, it may be useful further to conceptualize a third domain which was never bordered so rigidly, and that I call communication space, in which ideas are exchanged either by personal exchanges or by the media. Communication space lends itself to a mapping of densities, as again the French have done, but I'm sure others with respect, is one with respect to telephone calls. This is a map of the telephonic intensity among French users of the telephone system. So you get different spaces where Paris people call each other a lot within Paris, but these are the networks of spaces. And network analysis is obviously, I don't follow it, but it's obviously a big theme in sociology. So a modernist effect might be construed as a postmodern map, territorial map. The national border is there. The French will always have their hexagon, but it isn't really what is particularly relevant. Now, communication space. The theorists of this are been people such as Jürgen Habermas, in terms of a public sphere. Benedict Anderson in terms of imagined communities, obviously. The late Carl Deutsch, whose work was really quite profound and saw nationalism as arising out of a density of communication. Canadians Harold Innes and Marshall McLuhan proposed what amounted to histories of communication in different ways. And the internet and the web further freed this domain from the constraints of territory. Despite the public malaise created by the divergence of decision space and identity space, no protests are raised about the unbordered and deterritorialized domain of the World Wide Web. I shouldn't say that, as after I wrote that, I reflected the Chinese are obviously get disturbed at this, and I'm sure you know various agencies monitor it all the time, and we give them the right to do so for better or worse. But it isn't illogical that, by and large, this is a freer domain. The public understands generally that communication space is not, by its nature, a bounded domain, and it should be exempt from bordering. But at least since the 17th century, identity space and decision space were expected to share the same perimeter. This congruent relationship has been eroded. Now, the lecture is not about globalization, which will probably come as a relief to you. We've seen enough about that. I'm not concerned with the solvent, so to speak, but what is allegedly being dissolved. To judge from public discussion, at least, the belief is prevailing that we all lived once in tightly constructed regions of the globe, often defined as nations, each with its well-defined border. And in part, this is what impelled me upon this set of reflections, that the discourse of globalization has presupposed that that territory has been a fixed quality of our collective lives without historical change over a long time. And most commentary thus has taken territory to be a permanent fixture of social and political organization, suddenly under attack, much like the great polar ice shelves, only now after millennia of frozen solidity melting into the sea. And indeed, as I said, this unavowed premise is one of the impulses that has prodded my investigation. The implication that some territorial terra firma existed unchanging throughout past centuries must arouse the historian's suspicion, just as should any claim to institutional fixity. We are, by nature and profession, Heraclitan, and consequently, I began to think about the potential changes in territory. At this point, it makes sense to become more analytic and specific about the concept of territory. It helps to consider, I think, two preliminary distinctions. The first is between the political and the sacred, and the second is between the political and the economic. As a political concept, I guess I swig this from the bottle. Well, I hope you'll forgive me. As a political concept, territory has always entailed the recognition that the world would remain partitioned by multiple units, none of which possessed world authority. Territory implies the contiguity of other territories. It is plural, and the authority that goes with it is not universal. Even a vast imperial territory, an empire, has limits beyond which may lie barbarians, that is, peoples and tribes who don't accept the empire, or other states and empires, or kingdoms and republics that claim their own territory and their autonomy. Religious authority, on the other hand, can be construed as to be universal or local. It claims souls and not acreage. With some exceptions, it is not territorial, although it often claims particular sites of authority or sacred power. The oracle at Delphi, the Dome of the Rock and Mecca, places such as Guadeloupe, Lourdes, Fatima, or Marpingen in Germany, where the Virgin has appeared. Significant for our inquiry is the fact that the sites of sacred authority are often sites of potential opposition to the political authority within whose territory they exist. Sometimes these sites claim just an immunity from worldly concerns, such as the more austere monasteries of the Middle Ages or the Jewish communities in 16th century Safed in today's northern Israel. Think too of the Shia challenge, based on authorities in holy cities and academies, the challenge to the Sunni or Ulama instituted Islamic authorities oriented toward political capitals. Sometimes these sites, these sacred sites and the people who occupy them, will intervene in politics. Recall Buddhist monastic rampages in pre-Tokugawa Japan, or the role just 2 weeks ago of the Buddhist monastery in the protests in Burma. Religious places tend to be counter-territorial. The Vatican may be exceptional, insisting on its own territory. When we invoke territory, though, we look to an area and a circumference. The religious site is a point, or more precisely, a small enclosure whose walls separate sacred from profane space. And those of us at a distance can orient our church altars, or our prayer rugs, or our mosques, or our synagogue arcs in the direction of these points. The territory has to look to a surrounding perimeter. And what is more, the concept of place in general has taken on a valence or resonance quite at odds with the idea of territory. This is the part where Robert Penn Warren would probably take exception. Place is generally evoked as a physical site that stirs emotion, but does not in its own right grip us by law and command. Place has become, as you know, a favorite trope of historians who associate it with collective memory. The philosopher Edward Casey associates the revival of place in his book, The Philosophy of Place, with existential human orientations in time and space, thus with Heideggerian concepts, and he values our rootedness in place as a healthy countertrend to the abstractions of modern bureaucratic administration. In this sense, Le Lieu de Mémoire, which Pierre Nora made famous, has taken on an almost a sacred aura. It resonates with the spirit of the past. As you can probably tell from my description, I do love landscape. I love to look out an airplane window and see it unfold beneath me. But I distrust our historical enthusiasm for place and for the local, for what the Germans call Heimat. Although place can galvanize local resistance to authority, think of Robin Hood and Sherwood Forest or social bandits and Chiapas rebels, it is often deployed with implicitly traditionalist and conservative goals concealed by sentimentality. Place too easily serves as a utopia of Gemütlichkeit, a site of nostalgia. Place entails the pastoral and an Arcadian denial of politics. Place is where we take our vacations from change. In many usages, space too is an alternative to territory. If place is the right-wing alternative, space and spatial have become left-wing analytic tropes. Space, in this sense, refers to the construction of locations for claims to power and wealth. To invoke space, however, does not entail either identifying a particular site or drawing a boundary. Space, in the analysis of the French Marxist Henri Lefebvre, is less a Kantian a priori than a social a priori or category created by capitalism, and its reach is global. David Harvey and Edward, I don't know whether he pronounces his name Soja or Sawyer, the geographer, but he's at UCLA, have combined this mode of analysis with the claim that postmodernism represents a stage of consciousness which renders manifest the capitalist construction of spatiality that has characterized the last few centuries. Soja is particularly insistent, and he cites Foucault's observation, quote, that the great obsession of the 19th century was, this is from an interview Foucault gave in 1980, the great obsession of the 19th century was, as we know, history, with its themes of development and of suspension of crisis and cycle. The present epoch will perhaps be above all the epoch of space. We are in the epoch of simultaneity, Foucault says. We are in the epoch of juxtaposition, the epoch of the near and the far, of the side by side. One could perhaps say that certain ideological conflicts animating present-day polemics, again, this is still Foucault, oppose the pious descendants of time and the determined inhabitants of space, end of quote. And Soja, too, who is an inventive geographer, UCLA has owned one of the few geography departments still going in this country. He, too, Soja, claims that social science has unduly privileged history. Writing in the 1980s, he felt that, quote, the hoary traditions of a space-blinkered historicism are being challenged with unprecedented explicitness by convergent calls for a far-reaching spatialization of the critical imagination. As a member of a geography department, he perhaps has a guild interest in reestablishing his discipline. But now, as he calls it, modern geography. It's clear from the authorities he draws on that whereas the heavy weight of historicism is a German legacy, and I think it is in part, the new critical and Marxist geography he celebrates derives from French social theory. And I think he's right. Whether we turn to Foucault's lectures on territory, recently published, or to Lefebvre, or to the brilliant but obscure forays of Paul Virilio, Deleuze and Guattari and their Thousand Plateaus, the French have taken the lead. In so doing, they built on an older tradition of social geography, exemplified by Vidal de la Blache, who helped stimulate a century of territorially anchored social analysis and historical social analysis. This is one of this is a map of material and development of forms of construction, autonomous sources of civilization. But he has these global maps for different economic, material forces, cultural forces, and the like. This is a long way away from current theorizing, but the French over a century have been particularly, I think, concerned with space and geography. But of course, historians catch up with the social theorists. We are always the tortoises in the race, plodding but persistent. History has now taken its spatial turn, and new books appear at a continuous pace based on spatial consciousness and spatial categories. I would venture that my own programmatic statements might place me in this company, and yet I have a certain dissatisfaction with the new output, which is exciting and sometimes brilliant, but with often predictable conclusions. The criticism that follows should not obscure my great debts to this oeuvre, but mapping and state building are some of the favorite themes. Matthew Edney's work, Mapping an Empire, focuses on 19th century India. Tungchai Vinichkakul's Treatment of Siam is a book in which mapping is combined with invocations of biopolitics to discuss the emergence of Thailand as a bodily analog. Raymond Crabe's study of so-called fugitive landscapes, Cartographic Mexico, are all examples of work that is imaginative, but I think increasingly predictable. For all these studies insist on the same lesson, that to map or to survey is to try and establish mastery, either for the nation-state as a project or for colonial domination. This scholarship takes the nation from Benedict Anderson's imagined communities to what might be called dictated cartographies. This new history is similar to the current postmodern self-critiques in anthropology and political science, such as that of James C. Scott, who asserts in Seeing Like a State, all the state simplifications have the character of maps. They give us the evidence to support Foucault's basic insight that knowledge serves, indeed constructs power. That in the art of mapping, the new masters are creating their national or imperial domains. Moreover, maps, these authors point out, incorporate a form of historical narrative. They codify stories of mastery, of expropriation, and of empire. And this mastery is, for almost all of them, that of capitalist or modern technocratic elites who believe in a quality they increasingly call governability. Maps, in effect, are a sort of cartographic dream work. They realize the longings of power and domination, but they take us beyond fantasy to rule. We are such creatures as maps are made of. I would submit that the first generation of the so-called spatial turn, these books that I've been describing, has not gone far enough. Their findings, in fact, are rather ahistorical. They freeze the modern moment from a postmodern perspective and tend to rest content with the claim and demonstration that cartography involves state building, that lived space is socially constructed, but on behalf of its modern society's modernizing elites. Essentially, they have discovered the cartographic dimension of modernity and announced that as a sufficient finding, much like the first generation of gender historians discovered that women played a role in history. But human history, however, progresses through a long and continuing series of constitutive moments, and I believe historians and social sciences must apply the particular evidence privileged by the spatial turn to our long-standing methodology of sequential analysis and narrative development. That is, we must wed German historicist and French spatial approaches, if you will, and once we acquire the informed sensitivity to Chinese, South Asian, and Islamic approaches demanded by post-colonial historians such as Chakrabarty, we must incorporate these paradigms as well, which have developed their own temporal and spatial sensibilities. Let us use spatial analysis not just to expose and implicitly denounce the capitalist state as a spatializing project, but on behalf of a more sustained historiographical the enterprise. In the time that remains, I will try and suggest some beginnings. For those of you who read the essay I contributed to the American Historical Review, or the piece I referred to in the Festschrift, will know that I have sought to use modes of territorial awareness as an approach to thinking about the fundamental periodization of modern history. That is, to use space and territory to think about time, and thereby to render visible alternative approaches for our traditional periodization and narratives. In the way that radio telescopes reveal a different map of the universe from the ones provided by the spectrum of visible light. My effort today will be similar to those pieces in print, but I want to stress some different processes. In specific, I remain interested in the transitions from imperial, or what I've called spongy space, to national or administratively permeated space, but today I want to consider the issues raised by markets and commodification of land more closely than earlier. Start by considering, again, a few maps, or to be precise, land surveys. This first group I will show you, couple, are from a wonderful book by Valerie Kivelson, Cartographies of Tsardom, which presents and discusses them. And she offers maps from the late 17th and 18th century. A land survey is designed to sort out property claims, often as those she discusses between monasteries and their neighbors. This is a contention. This was drawn to sort out who owned the middle stretch of land. And the maps are evidence in court hearings and the like. And so you have little properties here. These are peasant properties. She makes the point that Russian peasants are far from being just the supine serfs that we often attribute to them. They are they maintain quite a sort of a quasi-autonomous existence. And the monastery wants something, and the peasants want something, and I'm not sure the peasants seem to win this battle. But this is a land survey, an early land survey. But we've got much earlier ones. Domesday Book that William the Conqueror commissions is also, of course, a land survey to record and post sources of public revenues. The cartographers of Muscovy did land surveys, but they also drew maps of a realm that, as early as the 17th century, was reaching the Pacific. This was imperial space, and they had a concept of how it must be drawn. It encompassed diverse peoples and geographic features. Its frontiers were remote enough, so they did not seem to be the essential, but the domination and the subordination of peoples seemed crucial. Valerie Kivelson emphasizes further, the public maps were records of submission and of tribute, not of assimilation. Each people was represented by its name or image. Here are some, this is a man named Remezov who kept a whole notebook of maps. You see here, he's got, He's got different, the details would indicate different sorts of settlements. There are Russian settlements and there are Mongol settlements. Some of them, the Mongol yurts are clearer than here, but this is a map of empire and of expanding empire. The notion that imperial rule in effect preserves ethnic identities would be subordinated to Russian nationalist state-building projects in the 19th century. But it continues to play a role, as Terry Martin has demonstrated in his study of Soviet state construction, the affirmative action empire, if only sort of a ritualistic role. Kivelsen also stresses that the enslaved peasantry had their huts drawn on the property maps, and she contrasts this with maps of slave estates in the American South, where slave quarters do not usually appear. The Russian pre-modern spatial representations fulfill what we in the modern era would prefer to separate as two separate functions. The ones of property holdings termed cadastres serve an economic purpose. They attribute revenues either to landlords or tenants, or in the case of tax surveys, to the state. The ones of empire reveal political subordination, submission, and overlordship. It would be ahistorical to separate these functions too radically. This is my favorite. This is another early cartography of Muscovy. Again, these are peoples, and they've been colored. This is called an ethnographic map. Not much has been said about it, but this is Tartary, obviously. And these are the different peoples encountered as the empire expands and incorporated into the empire. It's quite beautiful. And generally, it goes from south. The south is at the bottom of these maps, and the north is at the top. Sort of like a rug. These maps seem to be collected from around 1700 to 1720 or so. There's a whole folio of them, and he obviously kept sticking maps in them. Some of them, I realize, are in Houghton Library. I'll have to go look at them myself sometime. But you have both the cadastre, the tax map, or a land survey, and the state map. It would be ahistorical to separate these functions too radically. The maps confirm that land and territory play a double role, economic and political. The landed economy is the source of the state's revenue, as well as of the landlord's rent and the peasant's subsistence. It is, in effect, a triangular conflict between peasants, landlords, and state, and indeed, we often diagram this, I often do to my students, because it continues so throughout history, as a triangular relationship with the state apparatus, bureaucracy, army, display at the very top, and aristocracy, and then peasants, or later workers in the mass at the base of this triangle. So we can, in effect, impose both a geometric abstraction and a spatial abstraction on this. And much of early modern history, and I think modern history too, is the conflicts between those class claims. Both sorts of maps will continue to be generated side by side, as it were. It would be incorrect to state that the map of public space totally will displace the cadastre. They are twin tools. Anyone buying a house, at least when I bought my house, has to have the deed inscribed in his city record of land holdings. The Germans refer to the Grundbuch. And I want to follow the trajectory of these two sorts of maps as representations of twin efforts side by side. They can use different tools and different technology. The land survey is often a local product. Village elders or trained surveyors must walk the land. When sometimes you go and you ask the elders who owns what. Sometimes you get surveyors where there are fences and to measure it again. And they inquire into property lines. But the public map, the large-scale map and its successor, became a geodesic exercise, sometimes allowing for the curvature of the earth, using triangulation to be able to double-check points, and grids for multiple points of coordination. As might be expected from the era of so-called enlightened despotism, the 18th century and early 19th century formed the great era of I think, cadastral surveying. And the chapter in my book I will devote to this, I will call a cadastral century. Governments throughout Europe need tax revenues. They especially needed them in a century of continuing warfare. Surveying techniques improved. Taxes were imposed and contested. Here's just a few illustrations. This is the Savoy cadastre. This would be French territory today of 1732. It's an early and quite precise one. And this is part of the area of the commune of Metz in this period. And what is surprising is, I'm sorry, this is such bad quality, but it is really, and I don't know why, but this is a Danish land holdings of 1769, and this shows Swedish enclosures. In fact, despite the difficulty with these images, these are the most some of the most sophisticated cadastres of the century. Sweden and Denmark, the Swedish land surveys were carried out in the service of the great enclosure movements that took place during this epoch. Sweden and Denmark also possessed at this time or earlier territories in today's Germany to the south of the Baltic, and the Scandinavian methods spread thereby throughout Central Europe. Napoleon will order a new land survey for all of France, Le Grand Cadastre, that will begin around 1802, 1803, and it will entail a punctilious system centrally coordinated. The size of sheets, instruments, etc., is all carefully specified. One can follow an interesting local example in the Kingdom of Bavaria, which was simultaneously enlarged and almost bankrupted during the Napoleonic Wars. And Napoleon came through and ordered a geographic survey of roads by his military topography department, but then the Bavarian monarch would decree his own topographical atlas, and he instituted a so-called tax rectification in 1808 to measure all land for new and unifying taxation. The project would last until 1867. Inspired by the conviction that the state would otherwise remain a mere aggregation of fragmented possession, so the reformist minister Montchalas wrote, we have to found a uniform system. So the cadastral imagination, to extend the concept from one of mapping to governance more generally, thinks about the private and public economy as a whole. The private-public distinction does not help us much in reconstructing the 18th century policy world. Certainly it is a formulation that becomes important for appreciating the thinkers of the Scottish Enlightenment, most famously with Adam Smith, and it will permeate the distinction 19th century liberal thinking, but it's more normative than description. The most pervasive policy approaches of 18th century reformers resolutely connects the prosperity of both domains and hardly differentiates them, whether among cameralists or physiocrats. If one surveyed the continent and the colonies, as Emma Rothschild shows with her study of Turgot and Adam Smith, physiocratic thinking, I believe, becomes the most widespread strand of economic analysis in the 18th century. While its exponents reject much of the mercantilist effort to control economic parameters, it can also be construed, I believe, physiocracy, as an application of mercantilism and cameralism for societies still preeminently composed of landed wealth. Those of us who were trained in elementary economics at a British or American university too often dismiss physiocracy as a sort of economic phlogiston theory, an archaic doctrine which could not comprehend that there were other sources of surplus, economic surplus, beside the land. In fact, physiocracy was supply-side economics for agriculture. It broke free from the mercantilist assumption that the global economy was a zero-sum game, but it retained the mercantilist premise that a strong private economy served the state. The consequential part of the doctrine was the confidence that market principles applied to land would increase agrarian productivity. One did not have to follow the arguments or even the tableau économique of Quesnay to understand the policy prescriptions. Smith appreciated the intelligence of the economists, even if he critiqued them. Britain, after all, hardly needed their doctrines, since market principles for land had been
had long prevailed despite the concentration of actual ownership. To the physiocrats, cultivated land was the ultimate source of surplus that the state required for war and display and infrastructure. And to encourage agrarian production, grain prices had to be freed, which in case of dearth could lead to widespread hardship and public disorder. Decontrolling prices, however, was only a small part of the physiocratic program. The rationalization of land holdings, that is, enclosures, and the fixing of tax revenues to reassure investors in agrarian improvement were also crucial. And the widespread popularity of these reforms is striking. Under the reformist reign of Charles III in Bourbon Spain and his minister Jovellanos, physiocratic principles informed land reform as they did in some of the new republics of Latin America. Ministers in the New Republic of Argentina will treat the wealth of the Pampas in the same way. The British who hold Sicily during the French Wars and who govern Bengal will adopt measures in the same spirit. The governors of Bengal were admirers of Turgot and recommended physiocratic policies that underlay Cornwallis's, Lord Cornwallis, after he lost at Yorktown, he was sent off to Calcutta. He recommended a so-called permanent settlement by which it was meant a multi-year fixing of tax obligations for Indian landlords. The intention was not merely to encourage investment by landlords, but to transform tenants into a yeoman peasantry. The reforms, unfortunately, usually, went awry. In some areas, liberated serfs slipped into debt peonage, land ownership became concentrated, even absentee landlordism could increase. In Argentina, the hope of creating a vigorous class of landlords faded before the inroads of the gauchos, who became supporters of the dictator Rosas. In India, of course, pauperism increased, and these reforms failed. Designed to stimulate capitalism in the countryside, the new measures reinforced not the old feudalism, but new forms of landlord control and often exploitation. For the cadastral century, not only freed prices on grains, it removed constraints on land sales, such as the monastic dead hand, the accretion of land in church holdings, or remove the requirements of nobility to purchase land, all the restraints on commodification of land that we associate with the Ancien Régime or estatist societies. This amounted, I believe, by far in the hugest wave of socioeconomic transformation before the advent of factory labor, and it had momentous worldwide consequences. Church lands accumulating for centuries were too tempting an asset for impecunious states. Britain again had led the way in the 16th century, but the Catholic monarchs of Spain and Portugal followed after 1867 with the secularization and sale of Jesuit lands in Iberia and the New World, the Desamortización. The French Revolution subjected church lands to national mortgage, to service assignats, and then sold many of these lands. The Spanish liberals after 1834 went on to secularize the remaining church properties. The Piedmontese liberals would do the same in the 1850s, as would the Mexican liberals in the 1850s and again in the 1860s after the French interregnum. The evidence we have suggests that waves of land transfer increased not only in Europe but Latin America. We know that this commodification of land must have profound political effects, although close correlations remain to be carried out, and I certainly have not undertaken, I've just been reading rather scatteredly on all this. Collective usages in village property rights were diminished. New prosperous landowners would take advantage of the auctions. And we know that in general the results did not primarily benefit small peasants, but rather reinforce prosperous landed middle classes. And analogous, although we can look at the Catholic lands, analogous liberation of land as in Prussia and elsewhere in Central Europe will take place at the same time. what we could call the Great Land Auction. Generally, the Great Land Auction of the era from 1760 to 1860 is presented as a result of political transformation. But surely the relationship must be reciprocal. Subjecting such vast reserves of land, occupied land, to the rules of the market, ending the non-economic barriers to purchase and sale, whether ecclesiastical or estatist or collective, because village rights are also infringed in this. This transformation must have had a role in undermining political systems based on custom and privilege. The protagonists of the cadastral century sought to systematize property and enhance its yield, but they ended by subjecting the countryside to the forces of the market and thus eroding all those customary structures of land and territory that upheld the diverse ancien regimes of the early modern era. As population grew, the necessity and the impulse to sell and to let the market forces reign continued apace. And with this a series of global political upheavals, these upheavals could produce purposive revolution, but also just millenary and revolts against authority, as we see this you could argue this for the case of the Taiping in China, or it can produce also a reinforcement of authority, as in the Meiji Restoration. A second wave of land commodification gathered force in the second half of the 19th century. This was less the consequence of secularization or confiscation than of the appropriation of new territories, whether in the interior of Latin America or the United States, or in the colonies. Public authorities will transfer vast new areas of public domain into private hands in the second third of the 19th century. In the case of the United States, the Homesteading Act allowed a broad segment of smallholding farmers to emerge, many of immigrant stock. But the governments of the United States and the Canadian provinces grant vast swaths of territory to railroad companies for the sake of transcontinental rail lines. And some of these encourage broad popular settlement to make their new routes profitable. Areas of Africa are opened up for European settlers. At the same time, we see urban expansion and rebuilding in such ancient cities as Rome and Madrid unleash a large speculative wave of real estate development in the 1870s and 80s. Like the railroad companies, the urban building societies brought together old elites, often of aristocratic lineage, with new banking and industrial bourgeois. The developmental coalitions of the 19th century, spiritual descendants of the physiocrats, had no patience with traditional or collective rights. The Mexican liberals, as well as the cientificos who set their stamp on the regime of Porfirio Diaz from the 1870s to 1910, will endow Mexico with railroads and new mines, but Indian village property will dissipate. The British will endow their India with railroads, but impoverishment will progress. In the United States, Native Americans will cede more and more of the small allotments that they had retained as they retreat to the reservations preserved for them. Russian villages will retain their communal rights to land redistribution, but by 1911, the regime will end their compulsory rights to. The railroads facilitate these social trends in many different ways. They open up new lands, they facilitate the vast spread of commercial production of grain and meat for remote markets. Where privately owned, they serve as an instrument, as I said, for receiving public funds and land for stockholders, for a stockholder bourgeoisie that merge older rural magnates and newer urban wealth. Once again, I believe it is no accident that such changes culminated in vast revolutionary upheavals. Not everywhere, of course, but in many places. Protests against the remaining old regimes and sometimes against the very processes of economic development. The revolutions of 1905 in Russia, 1908 in the Ottoman Empire, 1910 to 1920 in Mexico, after 1911 in China, they reflect a lot of difficulties. They reflect the hammering of these societies by the newer imperialist societies, but they also reflect this social upheaval within, the societal stresses that these vast transformations of ownership and commodification have caused. We tend to associate the great revolutions with urban upheaval and the advent of a factory proletariat, but it is the unremitting spread of rural market relations that provide its mass force outside Europe. Now, so far, it has made sense to follow this process as one of commodification, of subjecting the countryside as a revenue-producing resource increasingly to the laws of the market, of freeing producers from restrictions on prices and from restraints on purchase and sale of land. Likewise, of, quote, freeing the labor on the countryside from restrictions on movement or on acquisition of individual holdings, such as imposed by East European serfdom, Western Hemisphere slavery, or collectivist village rights east and west. Such freedom, of course, meant the liberty to enter into debt peonages in the American South and elsewhere. The process has often been described sometimes as as capitalism in the countryside, sometimes as economic development. But as Karl Polanyi made clear in his book, The Great Transformation, market and politics are intertwined. Again, the lesson of those early maps. Let me show you a couple of remaining maps, one of India, the other of Mexico. This is the empire to be. It reflects, Matthew Edney has it, the Great Land Survey. The British have not yet reached area that's today's Pakistan, but they clearly had a plan for scientifically measuring and bringing order to this countryside. This one didn't come out as well. This is the Republic of Mexico. Again, the grids are imposed by this new project, which starts in the 1850s and goes in through the Porfirian period. Each results from a survey sponsored by the political authorities, who want to conceive of their vast landscape as a coherent space represented by a quadratic or a triangular grid. They are geodesic surveys scientifically carried out by state bureaucracies. They are designed to make political authority visible. They are exercising what has been called governmentality, often accompanied, as in the case of the United States censuses, by the counting of populations, of races, and national ancestry, and of professions as keyed to territory. Underlying these exercises is the belief that national or colonial territory forms the source of wealth and power and often energy, not just because of its grains or minerals, but for all the human resources it can domicile and shelter, indeed for its very spatiality. I am not enough of a constructivist to maintain that capitalism constructs space as such, but the architects of national development can rarely contemplate measures of progress or collective prosperity without envisioning territory. In the last analysis, the surveys are the product of, in a sense, a neo-mercantile as well as a proto-capitalist vision of order and progress, to cite the Brazilian Kantians, who are in effect the Kantians' descendants of Saint-Simonians and physiocrats. The territory of the nation aggregates the cadastres and indeed raises their measured spaces to a new level. Let us call these the cartographic vision of the nation or of its imperial possession. They are not, the men who do these surveys are not preoccupied by so-called private property holdings, but they are preoccupied by territorial coherence, filled in areas and firm frontiers. By emphasizing national or imperial bordered space, they invoke what the cadastres usually omitted, the framework of public claims. Perhaps more carefully stated, they focused on what the cadastres, the tax surveys, left implicit, namely that there was a public interest in private holding. The cadastral consciousness of the 18th century flows into the 19th century's cartographic vision. But there's another quality to the territorial maps. The great cartographic surveys are expressions of belief that territory in itself is a source of productive and administrative energy. I have suggested in my earlier essays on this theme that what, following Foucault, we might term the territorial episteme, shapes the construction of knowledge in several spheres simultaneously, whether governmental or scientific. And the inspiration behind these cartographic depictions is the same as that underlying, in this case, the new physics of the late 19th century. It is the administrative and geographic equivalent of envisaging fields of physics, magnetic fields. Did the commissioners and consumers of the land surveys as school children do what we did as school children, sprinkle iron filings on paper held over bar magnets to visualize how electromagnetic fields energize space itself? Every point on the paper, every point in the territory, according to Faraday's and Maxwell's 19th century theory, had an energy level associated with it. In the same period, the explorers of the American Rockies will take their theodolites, measure magnetic fields, to mountain peaks to measure the electrical fields. sometimes with disastrous results during electrical storms, and compass orientations. The national territories will be sources of energy even when no crops are grown, even when it remains wilderness and should be preserved as wilderness, which for such proto-environmentalists as John Muir or Wesley Clark Powell is as much a national resource as arable land. Moreover, this new sense of territorial energy spreads from Europe and North America to the more archaic empires into the enclosure of colonial territories. These maps show you, I can't go over in detail, when frontiers are drawn. And these are frontiers before 1900. There are very few of them, some in Europe. Or before 1800. Before 1900, you have the New World frontiers, as some are contested, and a few in Africa. Where there is no frontier, it will be contested. By 1920, considerably more, including the colonial ones on the edge and somewhat in the interior of Africa, and by 1948, in a sense, the modern global space has been closed. Now, so this is a recent effort that's progressive. One can instructively follow Ottoman Empire efforts to systematize. We have good studies of this. Their southern Middle Eastern possessions in Jordan and Syria to transform their networks of clientelistic relations with Bedouins and local pashas and impose territorial bureaucracies, telegraph and railroad lines, and military control, and the clock towers that are put up in all these cities in the 1870s. The effort would, in the words of a recent study, quote, change the face of land ownership in the region forever, unquote. Land and rule had to be transformed together. The earlier grants of tax farms, which had replaced the feudal timars, would be transformed along lines of Western-style land ownership by the Land Code of 1858. Sheikhs and elites would not be eliminated, however, but they would enter into a new set of collaborative relations with the state, as did the magnates in so many of the great landed societies of the globe, whether in China and Russia, the Kingdom of Hungary, or the American South. The cartographic vision of the nation, like the cadastral vision, had to rest on collaboration with the local, and it tended to modernize local power, not to subvert it. The late 19th century rationalization of territorial control, moreover, was intensely competitive. It expressed itself in geopolitical imaginings in which strategists such as Halford Mackinder and his German counterpart Karl Haushofer reassigned decisive weight to the continental masses of Eurasia. From the geopolitics that motivated national socialist policies to the rhetoric of bipolarity in the Cold War was an easy extension made plausible by the range of long-range bombers and intercontinental missiles. Most of us over the age of 50 still came of age with that imaginary of global politics and global strategic space. Let me conclude. I've tried to suggest that the representation of territorial property and of state domains are separate but intertwined. I've sought to argue that the cadastres expressed the early stages of the impulse to commodify land and extract its revenues, but that this effort would sweep up global societies into revolutionary unrest, first in the interval from 1770 to 1830, and then again when public domains were augmented and reprivatized in the first decade or two of the 20th century. I have tried to show the dialectical progress from cadastre to map, or from cadastral imagination to cartographic vision, the latter key to a new sense of energy-filled space that pervaded politics and science alike. I am not claiming that mapping caused these transformations. Neither am I stating that map-making is equivalent to nation-building. Rather, it is an expression of changes in domination and control, of new technological possibilities and scientific insights, which, like the iron filings, leave their traces of energy fields on sheets of paper. They make visible what the elites of the 19th and 20th century were convinced was the underlying structure of societies constructed on the surface of the globe. As I have suggested earlier, the watersheds in these changing views do not follow the great political landmarks, whether 1789 or 1914 or 1945 or 1989, but tend to precede these political cleavages, whether from 1750 to 1780, 1850 to 1880, or since 1970 when a new spatial imagination has come to dominate. I do not mean to evade causal. By the way, agents drawing frontiers. These show that it's outside agents. I do not mean to evade causal questions, but I see causal linkages like a matrix of simultaneous equations or the giant spreadsheet of history. Change one variable or one coefficient and all must change at the same time. It is the military expenditures of the 18th century that require tax rationalization. Enlightenment ideas that allow cadastral surveys and fiscal reform, the development of steamboat, railroad, and telegraph that allows the vast opening up of national and imperial hinterlands, the progress of military competition, new scientific insights. I cannot give causal precedence to any one of these any more than one can in a matrix, again, of simultaneous equations. They are co-determinative. But by studying these visions of land and territory, we can gain clarity into the simultaneous transformations underway. Of course, the story does not end with these maps. We can take the 20th century conflicts and their visualization, whether in geopolitics with its notion of the world island and the heartland, or in the Cold War images of Iron Curtain and Berlin Wall and 38th parallel, as the triumph of a coherent territorial imagining generated by the 19th century. But how should we describe our own spatial vision in the age of globalization, of migration, of diaspora? Is it the iconic view of spaceship Earth from the satellite? Is it the capacity to swoop down from the stratosphere to see our own houses and gardens that Google Earth puts on our computer desktops? And how do we envisage our frontiers? Perhaps drawing inspiration from Solzhenitsyn, we might think of the airport archipelago in which modular chunks of frontier materialize at identical passport windows, whether at JFK or Heathrow or Narita or Charles de Gaulle, or elsewhere replace the continuous border outlines of our 19th century territorial representation. My sense is that we've reconstructed the 19th century frontier into an even more omnipresent capacity for surveillance that we can switch on at any location agreed upon. Some of that is the result of 9/11, but most was already a correlation of globalization. We have torn down the Berlin Wall. Someday we shall dismantle the 38th parallel, but we have eliminated the distinction, perhaps, between controlled and uncontrolled space. However, it will take a future historian to describe what has occurred. Hopefully, we can help alert him or her where to look. Thank you.
Thank you, as always, for a very stimulating, thoughtful lecture. We have a little bit of time for questions, so if you would like to take questions, that would be
sure. But why don't you, shall I recognize questions if there are any? Okay, I can recognize.
This was very thought-provoking. I wonder, though, about the grand narrative, because it seems to me that the map narrative that you're laying out, centered in the cadastral survey, is a state narrative. And if you tried a different narrative, which might be a nation narrative, which is, until the 19th century, not, as you know, not coterminous necessarily with a state, I wonder if you wouldn't have some very different hinges. And the point that I would think about this is, I find the connections with science, Maxwell, and with surveying possibilities in the 18th century, very convincing. But after all, the early map makers did not have so much, they had science in their mind, but their image of what they were doing is not a scientific, but an artistic one. When they make a map, they make a picture. The initial analogy is, in that sense, art. Striking in this respect to me is that the nationalists, when they begin to think about nations in, let's say, the late 19th century, what do they turn to? They don't turn to science, which they might, but they turn to poetry. Now, Herder imagines that you want to understand a nation, you have to understand its poetry. And so I wonder if the narrative is the territorial narrative is really a narrative that is about states and territories as opposed to nations, at least in an older sense, and territories.
This question has a certain piquant aspect, since when Helmut came last year to give a talk at Harvard, I asked him, took him to task for ignoring the state. Okay, so your turn. Yes, I see a cluster of terms arising: state, sovereignty, territory, borders. There is a... I'm aware of the how maps evolve. This is my daughter's specialization, actually. She's just started teaching. I went to visit her at Tulane, and she writes on the early switch in maps from the I forget the technical terms, from the, you know, the landscape view to the topographical view, and what that means. But to come forward, it seems to me that when you start thinking on the public maps of the 19th century, there's implicitly these states are already implicitly thought of as national states. I mean, maybe that's wrong. In other words, the governmentality, this nice view, I forget the, I'm sorry, didn't have the book at hand when I wrote this, but this study of 19th century governmentality through the director of the decennial census. He's clearly associating variables of nationality with places, different states within the United States. So my sense is, I'm not denying that there aren't other roots of nationality, of sense of discovery. I mean, you know, I'm not claiming that Herder derives his thinking from Newton or the like. I am struck by the correlation of spatial concepts that pervade so much of a culture at one time. Why that happens, I'm not clear. But I think by the latter 19th century, the public mapping project implicitly entails much of what the nation works, so to speak. So it's true that the starting point is a pre-national starting point, but you have this sort of segue into the other, and I don't think it involves a breach or a different sense of difficulty. And picturization, sure, that can take place. Look, the great explorers, this scientific exploration follows for 30 years the Hudson River School and these painters who go out to the West and do these gorgeous landscapes and record Indians and landscapes, etc. So that there is a flow back and forth, and I wouldn't deny that. You know, anybody who looks at Bierstadt will see that. Please.
I think that my question is slightly a follow-up on Helmut's. I was actually interested in the tensions between the first part of your talk and the second part of your talk. In the first part of your talk, where you're doing a kind of literature review that's more conceptual of the tensions between territorial space as political space, between identity space and its discontinuity with decision-making and authoritative space, and then what seems to me more like a critique of sort of anthropological theorization of place and the local. And I guess that, and then you sort of return to the map as your site of engagement of the production of particular kinds of territory and spatialization. And that's very much, as Helmut points out, that's very much premised upon a particularly interested kind of visualization project on the part of those geographers that you're describing. And so I'm wondering about that tension between the critique that you make in the initial part of the paper and your own analysis, because I actually felt like something that gets overlooked is the extent to which those anthropologists like Harvey, and I would add people like Saskia Sassen and Doreen Massey, And even someone like a Padawan, who are doing the kinds of critiques that you're talking about of mapping and cartography as certain investments in imperial mastery, that it seems to me that there would be something to be gained by bridging those tensions. And I'm wondering why it is, or to what extent you would put yourself in conversation with those people as perhaps the component that, given that together methodologically, right, might yield us more insight into the very kinds of productions of territory and space that you're interested in, as opposed, and actually serve the project that you're talking about, of talking about the sort of linkage of things that are not separate but intertwined. And so I was actually really curious about the tension and the distinctions that you're trying to make between the ways in which other people are talking about space and territory and the political interests. And the thing that I would add is that those other folks are also really interested in what happens below the level of visualization that don't get exposed by certain interests in property, in land, in the asset. And that isn't our goal to actually try and understand the way those two things work together in a project of visualization that's both about erasure as well as putting something on the map.
Wow. on one level, yes, I mean, I guess let me, I'm not sure I would do anything but endorse that, but let me, the talk perhaps did go from an effort to think about the methods to an effort to give you some methods. I chose mapping not because all of this project is about mapping, in fact, only some of it is, but it's a way of, I mean, it's a rhetorical device in some way. I can show some pictures and they exemplify different approaches to territory. And it's, so there is a, mapping takes a more, a larger role in this talk than it will would in the project as a whole. And it exemplifies certain transitions or earlier transitions. My concern with the critique of these theorists, I think you've conflated two different concerns I had or two different approaches they might have. One is with the local. My concern with place, and that's not the anthropologist general. My indictment did not extend by and large to anthropologists in terms of place. It usually refers to the historians who have prioritized it, and it's just a certain uneasiness I have. I mean, the media love place too. The nostalgia of place plays a large role in public television, so to speak, and narratives. And I think it's misleading and blunts an analytical edge often. The anthropologists you cite, those of postmoderns, they're very different. I think I do question to what extent when the claims are made that the mapping in a sense constructs reality. I'm less of a social constructivist than some of these theorists, but they have a lot to say. And when I probably can't really answer you sensibly about how to engage with Paduri and others at standing on my feet at the end of this talk. Yes, they're interested in projects below the level of the map, and I think I would share that. And these are not anthropologists preeminently of the local. They're not people who go and take apart a given site. They are trying to deal with concepts of modernity and postmodernity, and by and large, I guess I would support your effort. I'm not sure what would. I don't mean to be hostile to them, and I've chosen that you're right. The talk has two halves, in a sense, because I'm trying to get into a topic and show why I'm thinking about it, and also find one of my own narrative strands to take you through it. But this is about an analysis of modernity and implicitly, therefore, post-modernity. Please.
Speaking about post-modernity, I have many, many questions, but I'm just going to focus on one. More and more we spend our time, our both economic time, but also our imaginary time in a virtual world. And I'm wondering, in this disembodied world that more and more of our energy seems to be going into over the past 20 years, with an accelerating gradient, what will this do to the phenomenon that you're studying?
What will it, when you say what will it do to the phenomenon?
In other words, the fact that so much, what will happen to space, territory, in a world when so much more of our mental energy and our economic transactions and our, you know, the relationships that we have among ourselves as people is taking place in
well,
this disembodied medium.
I think, to put it crudely and far too oversimplified, you know, territory's on the way out. We don't, you know, we tune into something on the web and it comes from everywhere and nowhere. More of us travel different places. My grandson has three different nationalities. It's this type of fixity is just dissolving, and it's precisely this process which is, you know, the owl of Minerva flies at night or dusk. It's precisely this transition which has led me to think about what was. I mean, you know, how do we get here? What was before that? And the notion that it was all the same though before that is ahistorical. But I think all this, you know, our virtual world, the fact that we see different, you know, see different places. The exchanges we have with colleagues, it doesn't matter where they are. Place is just, I think, except for when we want to celebrate it in this recreational or sentimentalizing way, is less relevant. Now, I have colleagues who will say that's nonsense. A friend of mine at MIT says, when you look, you know, don't dissolve the nation state prematurely, don't dissolve the frontier prematurely, you look at exchanges. And yes, of course, we're extrapolating, but you know, the consciousness of the chattering classes, so to speak, is always key to what's happening at sort of, you know, frontier. I mean, you know, in an era when most of our congressmen just got their passports a year or so ago, it's clearly I'm describing something which is, you know, a long way from day to day. But it doesn't mean it won't sweep us up.
We have time for one more question.
Well, there are two. Why don't we just let people ask questions and then I'll resolve them. I'll try and handle them as best we can.
Thank you very much. Like Michael, I have many questions because you gave us a far-ranging talk. I too saw two parts, one which was seemingly aimed at explaining to us that territory is not just about land, but then the bulk of the maps was all about land. And I want to actually focus in on something you said toward the end of the talk. Remind us of that point, whether it's Jerusalem or Mecca or spaceship Earth, that point of orientation, which seems to serve as the center for all the grids and coordinates that we create, so that maybe it's not a question of mastering the territory, but charting a course, because we are like, well, as Hans Blumenbach said, we are like a ship, and we're always encountering shipwrecks. And using that metaphor, which is very, very old, to what degree can we take what you're doing and look at the grid making as a way of charting a course with which, for example, the European Union is confronted once again. How do we maintain territorial status? How do we maintain cultural identity, but at the same time expanding territory?
Why don't I just? Is it okay? You're the. If we can just get the questions quickly, and then I'll try and.
I think my point is similar to several. That it's the, has to do with the disjuncture between the first part and the second part. One of your most interesting comments about critiques of the postmodernist spatial.
Well, think of it as having gotten two talks for the price of one.
Well, no, this is, but disjuncture is very productive. So that's okay. What we're trying to figure out, because we're all very intrigued with this. The most one of your most interesting points of critique about the postmodernists who are dealing with space is that they are in fact telling a modernist story about a very linear story about the production of a very stable state. And you did quite a wonderful deconstruction of that with your insistence that there are different kinds of elements of society and history that get mapped, the sacred, the economic, the political, and we shouldn't assume that they all coincide. But when you got to the second part of your talk, I felt you were telling a linear story very similar to what you critique the postmodernists for assuming, and I guess I'll tell you what I wanted, or what I was expecting, which was a much more destabilizing story, where the mapping stories of the sacred and politics and economics and identity don't all coincide. It refers, in a sense, perhaps to what Helmut was talking about. Where's the art? And the point is not to exchange one for the other. That would be a mistake. But the point is to be aware of the different ways of mapping this history with an awareness that they don't always coincide, and that the points of instability are as important and as significant as a point of divergence. And I would invite you to say something about that.
Okay. Anything? Then that'll be it, I guess.
I also had a sort of version of your linear narrative that I wanted to try out and get your feedback on. I heard you starting with Weber in particular to express the sort of modern idea that territoriality is over land first and then people, because people live on the land. And through the narrative, like the maps, you showed that the political and economic have intertwined in a way to arrive at what you call potentially our current spatial vision, in which that has eliminated the distinction between controlled and uncontrolled space. That made me think that perhaps we derive a modern conception in which power is exerted over land and thus people, to now where power is exerted more directly over people. You said that you were expecting some kind of increased penetration of surveillance. I was wondering, I guess, if that was sort of your intention to move in that direction, and if so, that sounds like arrive back in some sense at the pre-modern notion of the sacred, which you described as over souls and not acreage, and neither local nor universal, but a more direct operative over not land and territory, but the physical or physical individuals.
Okay, let me try to do penance for everything I omitted in the second part of the talk in 2 minutes. The maps are about land. Yeah, that's true. That's, I think, what maps in the conventional sense are about. I'm not sure I would take the metaphor of the voyage. There are a lot of shipwrecks, but I'd have to think about that. But the grid map, let me talk about these. I think this question here about destabilizing my story. I focused on political economy, in a sense, in the second part. I introduced, and it was probably too much of a teaser in the first part, the notion of the sacred and the secular. But of course, obviously, this notion of religion has come back in a big way, not always the ways we like. And for someone who grew up as an intense secularist, and it's hard for me sometimes to come to terms with that. Look, the sacred, we could destabilize the story. If I wanted to, we don't have a blackboard, but if I wanted, again, the sacred space and secular space, This is a distinction which is different from these other maps. It's an inside and an outside, I think, as I said. The verb of thinking on my feet, I conceptualize that. You know, the first, sometimes architecture is traced back to the notion of enclosure. What you do with, you enclose sacred space. But you can enclose it, but the maps are an enclosure of all of ordinary space. And that's the purpose of the grid, is to provide a sort of homogeneous type of territorial consciousness, which is adequate for the surface of the earth and the way we subdivide it and its economic flows. The sacred space is not like that at all. Sacred space is, there are points of intensity and then there are points of lesser intensity. And the religious person is oriented toward those points of intensity. And I would agree that's a different way of thinking about space. But I don't think it was the way. But in fact, the whole effort of the 18th and 19th century is to suppress that way of thinking about space. You have to build the state or the nation on the over the body of the church, so to speak. You have to, that's why there are these great conflicts in 19th century, century Europe. And so that the space, sacred space, whether it's in the shrine or whatever, is different. And so in that sense, there should have been, I could have given you three parts. The sacred cartography and the political economy cartography. I like to think of, but I simplify religion because having traveled a lot in different places, Every religion, I think, has what I call near gods and far gods. The far gods are the ones that are operate according to great laws. Marxism is the far god religion. Jansenism is the far god version of Catholicism. But then there are the near gods you see in Mexico, where postcards for God's providence, or in Naples, or my rule of thumb is I want to live in a far god. It's a country because it runs better, but I always want to take my vacations in near God. They are far more interesting than picturesque. And, take your vacation where they light candles and, pay your taxes where they, that's going to matter. So, the sacred is a very complicated thing, obviously, but it is a different sort of mapping. I didn't have time to bring into it. Maybe it's become relevant. I did, in fact, focus, flowed from one aspect of this to another. And, for those deficiencies, I see the points and I see the critiques. And the next time we'll do it.
Thank Professor Mayer for this wonderful talk and the exchange afterwards, and to invite you to a reception which will be held right outside.